Wing TV, with Victor Thorne and Lisa Giuliani. The revolution is being televised.
Hello, it's Monday, May 8th, and you're watching Wing TV. I'm Lisa Giuliani.
And I'm Victor Thorne. Welcome to Wing TV. It's great to be back here. It's a Monday afternoon, and there's a lot to cover. We've been off for basically a week, except for our show that we did a couple days ago.
I wouldn't exactly call that off.
Yeah. It was a lot of miles and a lot of running, but it's great to be back here. We're going to start right off today, first of all, with the big news. President Bush has announced his new CIA director, at least his nominee to be the new CIA director. His name's Michael Hayden, and he's going to replace, if everything goes according to plan for the Bush administration, Porter Goss, who's been in this job for, 20 months now, I believe? And he was forced out by John Negroponte. That's at least the behind the scenes.
They sung his praises there to get him in, and now he's ineffective and not doing it. He's an ineffectual leader.
Right. Well, already the blather has begun in Washington, D.C., and there's factions that don't want Michael Hayden in. They said that there's no way that a military man should be coming in and becoming the head of a civilian intelligence agency.
I think there's also questions on how well he's going to interact with Rumsfeld.
Right, right. Well, here's what Michael Hayden is. He was a former director of the NSA. That's the Puzzle Palace. He was the first deputy director of the National Intelligence Agency. This was started after 9/11. He was in charge of national security and these warrantless wiretaps. And he was also the head of the domestic spying program. So what this guy is a spook. I mean, he's a spook right to his core.
Yeah, a spook.
Yeah.
And I guess they want to take the CIA into a whole new direction, and Porter Goss was resisting that.
Yeah, so this is the first day of this. There was a lot of talk over the weekend, but we'll certainly keep everyone updated on this. Before we move on, also, tomorrow, Tuesday afternoon, we're going to be on Kelly McGinley's show. That's the Barryan Chronicles. Thursday, we're going to appear on Visigoths from the Grassy Knoll. And tomorrow, we're going to have Russ Diamond, who's been on this show a couple times before. He was the founder of Pennsylvania Clean Sweep, where it says, in the upcoming elections, everybody that's an incumbent, vote against them. This is a very successful organization.
And they're
right
making
now
a lot of headway getting neophyte candidates to replace the incumbents in the upcoming elections. It's going
right
to be interesting.
Yeah, they have candidates all across the state, and he's thrown his hat in the ring himself, and he's going to run for governor against Ed Randell and Lynn Swan, who's going to run on the Republican ticket.
He's got two votes here.
He certainly does, for sure. Now, over the weekend, and this took a little bit of teeth pulling, but Lisa and I went to United 93. What were your thoughts?
One sentence sums it up. It is a lie made to commemorate another lie.
Exactly. I couldn't agree more.
That reinforces the myth.
Right. And if you want more information on this, go to the Wing TV homepage. You'll see our review of this movie. And you also see Lisa, the shirt that she wore to this movie. It said,
United 93 is government propaganda.
Right.
It's just a hastily scribbled shirt, as you can tell. And Victor caught a snapshot of it. I went to that movie in total protest, and everywhere we went afterward, we went to the supermarket, just stares from people.
And she had a Wing TV. Get that sticker right there.
I was kind of hoping somebody would get in my face about it, but nobody did. They just stared.
Yeah. She had a sticker similar to this one on the back.
The one that I had said 9/11, the big lie, proven through laws of physics, and our website on it. And
so
that was on the back of the shirt. So
right. But anyway, this movie, when I was watching it, it reminded me of Leni Riefenstahl. And for those of you who don't know her, she was the famous female German propagandist movie maker. And she would have been proud of what was done in this movie, because it's nothing but propaganda, and you can tell how frightened the people in power are by how much they have to keep ratcheting up the propaganda. And this one here, the government went hand in hand with Hollywood.
Right, and Hollywood rewrote history.
Right. And see, the difference, though, between Leni Riefenstahl is that she was a Nazi propagandist. Well, what this is right now is this propaganda is coming out of Jewish-dominated Hollywood. So you can see a difference there,
right.
But the ends still are the same when it comes, or in terms of the means, because they're using propaganda to reinforce their official story.
Right, and just like the government's official conspiracy theory regarding 9/11, this movie, from soup to nuts, is total fiction.
Right. It opens with a shot of four Muslim men praying in Arabic.
That would be the hijackers.
Right.
Praying in a hotel.
Right.
Which, of course, they don't know that that happened whatsoever.
Exactly. And what this does is it sets the tone for who you, the moviegoer, should be directing your hatred
right.
towards. You know right off the bat, this is the enemy.
They should have had like a flashing light. Enemy.
Yeah.
Enemy.
Yeah.
Enemy.
Yeah,
they
like,
also
you know,
show a hijacker shaving the hair off his stomach. I don't know even where they came
yeah.
up with that one.
I don't know what it means. But you know how they have in TV studios like an applause sign that keeps flashing? That's what they should have had in the movie was
uh-huh.
enemy, enemy. Start flashing it so nobody could be mistaken. But so they're focusing all this attention on these areas, making up dialogue out of thin
yeah,
air that
like,
they have no idea.
After they show the four hijackers entering the Newark airport, they have them sitting, waiting for the plane. This one hijacker, he makes a cell phone call to an unnamed, unknown person, and he says, "I love you."
Mm-hmm.
Where did they get that one from?
Yeah.
I don't know. They do mention a large-scale military exercise off the East Coast that occurred on 9/11
mm-hmm.
in the movie, and they say that offshore routes were closed. They start off by trying to contact Flight 11, and they're not getting any
mm-hmm.
response. And so they're showing how the air traffic controllers are subsequently starting to flip out more and more and more. The blips go off the screen, and everybody's in a panic, and they're trying to contact the military. And it was like pandemonium. They're
right.
trying to show incompetence.
Yeah. And the other thing, though, that they're overlooking is the vital aspects of this flight. And first of all, there is a capacity of 289 on a Boeing 757. There were only 37 paying customers on that flight. That means that this flight was 87% vacant.
In fact, one of the flight attendants makes a comment,
yeah.
real flippant, "Love those light loads."
Yeah.
Like that's a normal thing, that a flight like that would be so under capacity.
No, but all four flights that morning,
right.
all four of the famous 9/11 flights were equally as vacant. So basically only one seat out of 10 approximately was filled on the morning of 9/11. And anybody that knows anything about the airline knows they simply don't fly with that few customers.
When we were on the Lionel show, a flight attendant called into that show and she said she'd never heard of a transcontinental flight with such a low capacity of passengers on the plane. She said it's unheard of. It's unthinkable because normally what they'll do is they'll cancel the flight and wait
right.
till they have enough people to fill it up, and that's why a lot of times people experience such delays.
Right, they'll lie about it. They'll say there were mechanical difficulties or weather or whatever, but they're not going to put 12 or 13,000 gallons of fuel in an airplane to fly all the way across country for 37 people. What they'll do is just bump all of them to the next flight. So you have four flights that morning, all of them with only about 20% capacity. But this is completely overlooked.
Right. We also noticed that they didn't show any times
right.
during this whole movie. So it's very hard for the average viewer who's not aware of all the other information regarding 9/11 to gain an accurate perspective on the chronology of events. And they show that the takeoff time for Flight 93 was 30 minutes delayed when actually it was, 42 minutes
yeah.
delayed.
Yeah, 41, 42 minutes. And this is vital. Anybody that reads Phantom Flight 93 realizes that this 41-minute takeoff delay is probably the most crucial aspect of 9/11 in foiling the master plan. But this is completely, again, glossed over. Now, Lisa mentioned the stand-down. And as this is going on, they made it appear as if there was such incompetence that they didn't even know which plane hit.
Right, the military
WTC
didn't know
one.
Which plane was up in the air and which plane had crashed. Now, how plausible is
yeah.
this? They were basically shoving all the blame, most of it, on the FAA
right.
and the military for not scrambling the jets. The military, of course, is passing the buck on to the president and the vice president. They had no contact with the president. They couldn't get rules of engagement, you know, the order for that,
so
and
it's
on
simply,
and on.
It's simply negligence incompetence, of course. They could get no scramble authority for the Otis.
And then when
fighter
they did
pilots.
Scramble, they scrambled unarmed planes to the wrong location. It just sounds like a bunch of bumblers.
Right, or they could get no clearance or authority for the shoot-down orders. They have these long-standing protocols that have been in line for decades and decades. No shoot-down orders. The chain of command is inexplicably disregarded.
Right.
All of these things, they just, you know, they put forward there to make sure that everyone knows that this is simply incompetence, that it wasn't an inside job, that this was all planned way beforehand. It was just simply they dropped the ball, lack of communications and so forth.
Right, and then they cleverly come up with all these little altercations between the hijackers and the passengers.
Yeah.
And this lovely scene where the hijackers are confronting the passengers, you know, that Let's Roll scene. And what we thought was very interesting was how Todd Beamer, Mr. Let's Roll, his role in the film was very minimized.
Right.
It was virtually not much more than a minor part.
Yeah.
And it looked like he wasn't even really part of the planning, if you go by the movie. And we wondered about why he was minimized so much in this film.
Right. Another thing we read in the reviews beforehand, and they touched upon it, was the infamous cell phone calls.
Uh-huh.
And what they did very subtly in this movie was all of these cell phone calls that were supposed to have been made at 35,000 feet, Todd Beamer on the phone for 15 minutes with Lisa Jefferson, the GTE operator, all of this was flushed down the memory hole right out of George Orwell's 1984. And what they did is replace them all with air phones, you know, the kind you have to swipe with a credit card on the back of the seat, because everybody knows that in 2001 it was physically impossible to make cell phone calls from 35,000 feet.
Well, what they did was they showed the hijacker at the plane controls, and he says, we're going to go lower, or something similar. And right after that, you see people using cell phones. In other words, their cell phones will work at a lower altitude.
What?
But then, even when we saw the crash, Victor, they don't show you the crash.
Right.
They show you the final scene, the plane just nosediving. Of course, they don't show the crash because people would expect to see plane wreckage and debris.
Yeah, and none of that's...
Right.
Yeah, wouldn't that be funny to see the plane crash and then the camera pans back...
To see a...
And there's a 10-foot hole.
An inexplicably clean... plane crash.
So they kind of left that out. They also left out Mark Bingham's famous cell phone call. You know the one where...
Hello, Mom. This is Mark Bingham.
Yeah. Left that part out of it altogether. And, you know, so many other things where what they did was just reinforce the official government story. We have a multi-billion-dollar defense industry. Pentagon, there's planes on the roof of the Pentagon, on the White House, anti-aircraft missiles, all of these things not taken into consideration. It's just that these four airplanes were hijacked. They flew through. Nothing could have stopped them.
Really, the only thing they had to say about Flight 77 was that it just disappeared. Poof.
Right.
And I just read a review of this movie someone forwarded to me, and this woman liked the movie. She said what she liked about it was how realistic it was. And how you got snaps of the pilot and the co-pilot talking about scheduling and little chit-chat among the flight attendants. That was what was realistic to her. But, of course, the main gist of the story is totally fiction.
Yeah.
It's like nothing to say. She says, so what if the historical information is inaccurate?
Yeah,
big deal.
What I told Lisa afterwards is if they made a movie about Noah's Ark and they had dialogue between all the people on Noah's Ark, they would have made that up out of thin air. It's the same thing they did with United 93. The whole thing, the dialogue, was made up out of thin air. These cell phone calls were not made as they said they were in a movie. And I guess to sum it up is, like Lisa said, this was one lie used to commemorate another massive lie.
Yeah, and you know, as far as movies go, even, it wasn't that great of a movie. There's a lot of jolting and a lot of people falling down a lot of the time, and then it was pretty mundane as far as the script goes, so I wasn't very impressed in that capacity either.
Whether people out there should go or not, if they haven't seen the movie, I'd say if you're curious about propaganda and how they're spinning 9/11 and Flight 93, by all means go. If you want to see a good movie, don't go to see this one.
And I guess a portion of the proceeds of this movie goes to help build the permanent memorial to this lie in Shanksville.
Which brings us now to some more information about our trip to Shanksville last week. And as we left, I said, the closer you got to the official sources in Shanksville, I told Lisa, the more it seems like they have a vested interest in keeping this lie alive for their own personal gains and for the gains of the town. So what did you find?
Yeah, I was looking up on the internet. PittsburghLive.com has an article that they interviewed a lot of the locals in Shanksville. And get a load of this comment. Other residents near the crash site talk wistfully of the days before September 11th, but say they feel honored that Flight 93 came down in their community. That it landed in a barren coal field seemed a blessing. They feel honored that Flight 93, if you're going to believe the government version, Flight 93, 44 people killed on that plane, landed in their community. What was it, an opportunity?
Yeah. I mean, a strange use of words.
Yeah,
to
I
say
think
the
that's
least.
A very, very unusual word to use. And then they, in this article, they say here, and all the media attention means more people will be coming to the crash site across the narrow valley. Someday it might have a permanent marker and be part of the national park system, locals figure. It might even be a talisman for other signs of rural progress, they say. Maybe a Holiday Inn or a Burger King.
Mm-hmm.
Just look at Gettysburg for proof. So even back when this, I'll have to look and see when this was written. I can't remember the date for it, but it was a while back, because it was when after Val McClatchy took her famous picture with the barn and the ordnance cloud behind it. But even back then, they're looking at it as an opportunity to improve their town and bring more money into their town.
Right, so they have a vested interest in keeping the myth alive, and that's what we noticed on there. So if you're a real estate agent, of course you would want the myth to stay alive, because they're getting supposedly, or they're trying to raise $10 million for the permanent memorial site. So that means if they get in a Burger King, a hotel, maybe a couple little stores, you know, souvenirs, everybody gets to make some money down there. But if the official version is blown to pieces and nobody comes there because they say, well, wait a second, all we have is a 10-foot by 10-foot hole that's 18-foot deep. Why would we want to go see that, especially when we know Flight 93 didn't crash land there? So, they have a vested interest in keeping it alive.
You know, this same article talks about Val McClatchy, the realtor that we were talking about on our last show. The picture that she took, she sells for $20 at Ida's store in Shanksville. Mm-hmm. 18 of it goes to the Todd Beamer Foundation.
Right.
And she keeps $2 per picture herself.
Val McClatchy, by the way, was the woman who kicked us out,
threw
of, her
us out
office
of her office
because she said she didn't want to hear any talk that was contrary to what the government told us is what happened.
Now, supposedly, just talking about this stuff upset her so much. Didn't she give you that impression?
She was shooting daggers out of her eyes.
That it was just too upsetting to the people around there. But in this article, she's quoted as saying, there are some people who just can't get past it, and they're out here every day, meaning at the crash site, she said. But it can get a little overwhelming. Like, she gives the impression in this article that, like Mike Rupert, you know, we should all just move beyond, get past it.
Yeah.
So she didn't seem very overwhelmed in this article here. And
she only seemed overwhelmed when we were bringing up all the inconsistencies with the government's official story.
Wondering about this obsession she has with her picture, because she's obviously the one who released it to the mainstream media,
yeah.
And that's how the people on the internet got it, you know, got a hold of it. In fact, I saw the same picture on Propaganda Matrix. So it's all over the place.
Yeah, she has a lawsuit against the Associated Press.
Supposedly.
She contacted Killtown, the website Killtown.
A 9/11 researcher, and threatened to sue him over the picture as well. And, of course, she hasn't, because she's just blowing a lot of hot air.
Yeah. So wait, one last thing now before we close the show today, and this still has me bubbling with rage.
Yeah.
Over the weekend, Patrick Kennedy, son of Teddy Kennedy, he's a congressman from Rhode Island, 6 terms, and he got caught again, or he was involved again, in another wreck. This was a high-speed, not pursuit, he was driving at a high rate of speed. His lights were off. This was at 2:45 in the morning. He was swerving on the wrong side of the road. He ends up smashing into a curb, nearly hits a police car. And then when the cop car turns around,
to the barricade.
Right. When the cop car turns around and pursues him, he doesn't stop. He doesn't stop the pursuit and ends up crashing into a barrier. When he gets out of the car, he sees it's damaged very extensively. He's staggering. He has a smell of alcohol on his breath. He appeared intoxicated. His
watery eyes.
Yeah.
Right.
And his speech is slurred. He's staggering and so forth. So, if this was you, or you, or you, anybody watching this show, what do you think would happen to you? First of all, you'd get a breathalyzer test, or they'd take you to the ER
and the reporting
and give
officer
you a blood test.
Did check off a box saying that he was impaired and under the influence of alcohol.
Mm-hmm. But instead of doing any of those things, instead of arresting him, they radio in to the muckety mucks, the higher ups, and they're told, why don't you just give him a ride home and we'll forget about the whole thing. And that's what happened. Now, a couple of the officers on the scene, Greg Baird and also a guy named Lou Cannon, are enraged about this because this is obstruction of justice.
These are the Capitol Hill police, right?
Yeah. Yeah. 3 weeks earlier in Portsmouth, Rhode Island, Patrick Kennedy was involved in another accident. He has a long history of alcohol abuse, drug abuse, and he just gets a free ride home. It's kind of like Monopoly.
Yeah. He claims he was disoriented by Ambien, which is a sleep aid, mm-hmm. and Phenergan, which is an antihistamine, both of which have warnings on their labels that alcohol use will increase symptoms of dizziness and so forth.
But see, we can't even look at that aspect because that's
nothing. We don't even know if he was taking those at the time.
It's
but
nothing
he smelled
but
like
a
alcohol.
Smoke screen. And there's reports now from the waitresses, from the maitre d', from other patrons at a bar called the Hawk and Dove, that they saw.
Walks like a duck, talks like a duck.
They saw Patrick Kennedy in that bar earlier that evening. And then, here he is. This accident took place at 2:45 a.m. Well, bars close at 2 o'clock a.m., all right? Now, he said that he thought he was confused, and he thought that he had to go to the Senate and cast a vote at 2:45 in the morning, which is absurd. But he used this excuse because whenever senators or congressmen use this, that they're in a rush to make a vote, the police have to let them through with no questions asked.
Well, so he was out of it, but not too out of it to remember how to get out of it.
Right. And this is an old trick I'm sure taught to him by his father, Teddy Kennedy, that said if you ever get in trouble, just say you're rushing to a vote.
Well, that's what Cynthia McKinney said, too.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Even at 2:45 in the morning. Now, the thing is the Republicans aren't making quite as big a stink about this as they should be. And why do you think that is? Because a couple months ago, Dick Cheney was drunk
and shot somebody in the face.
Yeah, so instead of wrecking his car and possibly killing someone, he took his gun.
Right, when he was
shot somebody.
Human hunting. Right.
Yeah, and almost killed somebody. Of course, Teddy Kennedy, decades ago,
killed someone.
Plunged his car off a bridge and killed somebody. Mm-hmm. But see, guess what? Dick Cheney's still in office. No charges were filed.
Ted Kennedy's still in office.
No charges were filed. Patrick Kennedy, still in office, very minor charges were filed. Nothing but moving violations and so forth. And Patrick Kennedy, instead of coming out being a man,
right,
fessing up that he was drunk, that he was driving drunk, that he could have killed somebody, he scampers off to another rehab facility, and he's going to hide out now until the heat's.
And he does what politicians do best, lie.
Lie. So, hopefully, these police officers, Greg Baird, Lou Cannon, and whoever else, are going to keep this alive. But you know what? I don't have a whole lot of faith because the next story will come up. This one will be shoved to the wayside. And Patrick Kennedy, he'll come back. He'll be all apologetic. He's better. He's fought his demons, and now he's going to lead American public.
He's in recovery.
He's in recovery from being a pathological liar. And there's no recovery for that. So
in today's photo gallery, we included some pictures from Kent State, Shanksville,
New
York City, and just
threw
them in there. So
and what song is it? Neil Young's Impeach the President?
Let's Impeach the President. Yeah. We love this song.
So definitely stay tuned for that. We'll be back tomorrow on Wing TV with Mr. Russ Diamond, and we'll be on Kelly McGinley's show tomorrow night, so tune into that. Until then, keep your eyes open. There's a lot of lies going on, and we have a lot of big things for the rest of the week. We'll see you tomorrow on Wing Radio.
See you then.